After the stunning success of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and settling into their new animation studio, Walt Disney and his team of animators set out to make their next animated feature film. After a few false starts and some other work, and on this work, we eventually got 1940's Pinocchio, what many consider to be the finest animated film ever created by any studio in the history of animation. The story of a wooden puppet who wanted to be a real boy taught us that dreams can come true when you wish upon a star, but you still had to work and prove yourself worthy of that dream. With delightful music, some of the best animation of the era, and groundbreaking effects animation, it remains one of the absolute pinnacles of Disney animated storytelling.
Walt Disney, you just made Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. What are you going to do next? Unfortunately, there's no Disney World yet, so...
Another movie that wasn't Pinocchio, except they all fell behind, so I changed my mind. I'm going to do Pinocchio instead.
Yeah, long story short. But, we already did Snow White, and now we've got the sort of sophomore effort here in Pinocchio to look at. Hi, this is Mike Minotti, joined by my brother, AJ Minotti.
Hello.
We're continuing our march through every Disney animated feature. One down.
One down and 52 to go.
53, whatever they are. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's hard because, I knew the number, then Big Hero 6 threw it off. You think I could just add one, but now I just, what is it now? But, welcome everybody. So, yeah, this is our Pinocchio episode, one of my favorites. So, I am super excited to dig into the production and the history, to look at the film and to see its influence in the parks, which is pretty extensive, as is this case of a lot of those Golden Age films. But we're going to start off with, like we did last time, with the kind of history and the production of the movie. So why don't we get right into that?
All right, Mike, so what was Walt Disney's mindset after the success of Snow White?
I think the whole studio was kind of on cloud nine. I think they kind of felt invincible in a way, right? You know, not only was Snow White a hit, it was a big hit. It was validating for Walt Disney in a lot of ways, because a lot of people said something like that wouldn't work. It kind of established the Walt Disney Studio, again, as not just like, you know, little shorts, Mickey Mouse, silly symphonies. Now they had this feature film. Now they were marquee, as you were. So it was a good time at the studio. Plus, they're also moving now from that old Hyperion lot into the Burbank studio, which is built by the funds from Snow White. So I feel like this is kind of an era of good feelings at the Walt Disney studio. Everyone is at the top of the game. They learned a lot from the production of Snow White. So now they're really ready to tackle their next movie, which was supposed to be Bambi. Bambi proves to be very challenging. Story-wise, to adapt it from the original source story, but also technically, because of the way they're going to animate the animals, which, you know, today, there's so many animal-based movies, but, you know, you look at Snow White and the animals in that, they're very cutesy.
And cartoony.
They're very cartoony. It's, when you look at the deer specifically, it's nice that they have deer. You compare the deer in Snow White with what we get in Bambi, big difference. But this isn't the Bambi episode, so let's cool our jets here. Yeah, Bambi becomes the fifth film, actually. In the meantime, however, they bump up Pinocchio a bit because they kind of know what to do with Pinocchio. They don't think there's very many surprises in it. Now,
that's what they thought.
Right. So Pinocchio, the original story, is by an Italian author called Carlo Lorenzini. He's better known by his pen name, Carlo Collodi. This is originally a serialized story, almost kind of like what Charles Dickens used to do with, like, a Christmas story.
Christmas Carol,
excuse me. Yeah, Charles Dickens' classic Christmas story with Ralphie and the Red Rider. and it's collected into a novel in 1883 called The Adventures of Pinocchio. It kind of like with a lot of the things that Disney adapts, the original tone of this is very different. It's very much a morality story aimed at teaching kids how to be good boys.
Kind of by scaring them into it
kind of by scaring them and kind of by negative example. Pinocchio is a jerk. Big meanie, big jerk. Interestingly, the Jiminy Cricket character, which is just called the Cricket, or like
the talking cricket,
shows up for basically two scenes. One scene where he tries to give Pinocchio advice and Pinocchio kills him. And another scene later where he shows up as a ghost. So, Wouldn't that be interesting if halfway through Pinocchio he just killed
Jiminy Cricket?
Yeah, people. Yeah, I'm still reeling in from poor Ray. I don't know how many insect deaths I can take in a Disney movie. So, Norman Ferguson actually brings a translated version of this novel to Walt Disney during the production of Snow White. So, interesting in a couple ways, because they're already, even while they're making Snow White, they're already thinking about future movies and stuff like that. And Walt Disney's very enthusiastic about this. He loves it, so it starts planning for that to be one of the future films. And again, once Bambi stuff happens, it gets bumped up, and it is going to be the second film. So, let's get a little bit into the development of this. Interestingly, Pinocchio's design took a bit of work. You can see some original stuff on him where he looks much more puppet-like.
More wooden.
Yeah, right. He looks very much kind of like a puppet, and it's interesting. Walt didn't like it, though. He thought that it was kind of hard to sympathize with the character that way. He maybe looked a little too alien, I guess you could say. So, kind of halfway through production, Walt stops everything. Mitt Call is the one who kind of thinks that they're going too far in this puppet direction. And he gets the idea that he's just look like a cute little boy who kind of has wooden joints and stuff, you know, so you can, you know, he's still a puppet, but making him easier to identify with.
What the movie does well, I think, is when it needs to be reminded to the audience that he's a puppet, and he does more puppet-like things, like, you know, during No Strings, his joints move around in goofy ways, but when it doesn't matter, he kind of just moves like a boy.
Yeah, like exactly. The puppet stuff kind of comes across a lot of times in the animation. It's always on your mind. I mean, first of all, because he's introduced as a puppet. It's not like it's something you forget about. So, Milt Call kind of does this test animation thing of the underwater sequence, actually, later in the film, and kind of shows that to Walt, and Walt likes it a lot. So that's kind of the new direction that they go with the character. Milt becomes the supervising animator on Pinocchio, with Ollie Johnson and Frank Thomas doing a lot of work too. So three nine old men right there. Speaking of nine old men, we have Ward Kimball doing Jiminy Cricket. Now, Jiminy Cricket is also added about halfway through production along with this redesign. Kind of because, you know, it's easy to say now, well, they need the sidekick character. There wasn't really a sidekick.
Yeah, that wasn't a thing back then.
Not really. If you look at Snow White and Seven Dwarfs, there isn't a sidekick character.
You can almost call the dwarves the sidekick, but not really.
Not really. They're kind of a force on their own. It's very different. So this is much more like, you know, like a Navi to Link kind of a thing here, you know? I'm sorry bringing in the other podcast into this, but... So they add the Jiminy Cricket character to, again, kind of be conscious. And this is, again, a test of Walt Disney's strength as a storyteller to kind of find this smaller character.
Well, and it also, you know, in a book, you can very easily read the inner monologue of a character to see the kind of moral dilemmas they face. But now that the conscience, in a way, is personified, you actually get the visualization of that internal conversation, which is really brilliant when you think about it.
And another smart thing about Jiminy is... he's kind of a modern, contemporary character in this timepiece, old-fashioned story.
Yeah, I find it very interesting that in the very beginning of the film, he actually is breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience.
Exactly.
Which, again, in the 30s, kind of groundbreaking stuff.
But, yeah, so he's narrator, conscience, comedy. He's a lot of things to this movie. But, again, you know, he's saying contemporary phrases at the time. Stuff like that, whereas, you know, everyone else is kind of more traditional. He's almost like Genie, like an early Genie.
A little bit, yeah.
Right? Kind of winking at the audience a lot, kind of acting like they would in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not quite as wacky as the Genie, obviously. So Ward Kimball does Jiminy Cricket. This is actually kind of a I'm sorry role given to him, because we talked about this on the Snow White episode. He animated the soup sequence in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which was cut from the film after animation, which was kind of devastating to work.
8 months of work.
8 or 9 months, yeah. So Walt Disney said, all right, you're going to animate Jiminy Cricket. And this becomes really the animation role, at least, that Ward Kimball is best known for. Mm-hmm. It's kind of his signature character. A couple other notable animators on this. We have Fred Moore animating Lampwick. He's kind of doing almost a self-caricature here. Lampwick is, of course, the boy who terrifyingly turns into a donkey later. Fred Moore is famous, actually. He would later go on to establish Mickey's modern look in The Sorcerer's Apprentice by giving him the pupils and all that jazz. Bill Tetla does Stromboli. And it's interesting because you find out he also later does Chernabog, and that makes so much sense.
He's very good at conveying weight in his characters.
And you wouldn't initially think those two characters have anything in common, but when you look at the animation, they're very forceful, kind of intimidating characters. Stromboli himself is an interesting character, kind of the range from comedy to frightening.
Yes, yes.
We have Art Babbitt as Geppetto, who, again, we talked about in the last episode. He was the evil queen in Snow White. And again, he's going to butt heads with Walt Disney later during the strike, which is really only a few years away at this point.
Right. Now, what I find interesting about Geppetto, and really a lot of the human characters in this movie, is I think they started to realize that they don't have to so strictly adhere to realism. They kind of took some of the design cues of the dwarves, as I see it, and applied them to more of the human characters in these movies.
A little bit. There is an exception with the Blue Fairy. The Blue Fairy looks much more...
more the classic, like, Snow White. Like, was she not, like, partially rotoscoped?
Well, again, rotoscope's not the word, I think.
Reference.
But heavy reference is what I would call it. Rotoscope is, like, what Flesher does in his Gulliver Travels movie, and it's weird. But yeah, no, I agree. Geppetto is much more characterized, which, you know, it makes sense. Interesting enough, and I forget his name, the actor who played him looks almost exactly like that.
Yeah.
And that's where they got that, the voice actor, I mean. And they did a lot of references with him. Apparently, the guy was kind of off his rocker.
Yeah.
Would talk a lot about Adolf Hitler during recording sessions. And, you know, America's not in the war yet, but it's not like we, you know.
We're not like, oh, yeah, he sounds okay.
That Adolf guy, right? So apparently they had to do a reference scene when he was on the boat during the fishing scene, you know, when Monstro's taking in all the water. And they apparently were rocking this boat pretty hard to kind of get back at him. Yeah. Take that, you Nazi sympathizer.
Oh, his name is Christian Rubb.
Christian Rubb.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a crusty-looking guy. But hey, he's great as Geppetto.
Yes. Wonderful performance.
Uh-huh. A couple other kind of interesting things just about the animation is that carriage, which kind of stands out when you're watching it, Stromboli's carriage. They did sort of an interesting technique there where it's not necessarily a live-action thing on there. What they did was they made a model of a carriage and then stop motion of it and then printed each frame onto a cell using kind of an early version of Xerox. And then they painted it over that. So this is almost closer to rotoscoping, really, than anything else.
And they would do a similar thing again in 101 Dalmatians, actually, with Cruella de Vil's car.
Right, right. So again, interesting thing. It kind of stands out a little bit.
In a weird way, it almost looks like it's CG, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does look like when they started, like, adding CG to 2D films. I know what you mean.
Like Pacha's cart in Emperor's New Groove.
Yeah.
It's a similar looking thing in a weird way.
It's kind of like...
I think it's because it's so geometrically perfect
in its
movement.
It kind of stands out.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting. For me, I don't know if this is getting the critique thing. It's one of those things that's almost a little weird. Like maybe, you know, I understand why it was a good idea, but you almost wish they could have just...
drawn it.
Yeah, a little bit. But one thing that doesn't deserve any criticism is the effects animation.
Which I think is the groundbreaking part of this movie.
It is probably the most impressive thing, especially the final act with Monstro, with all the bubbles and the waves. So effects animation is literally, you know, a lot of people don't think about it. They hear animation, they think, oh, I'm animating this character. But anytime you see a bubble, a thing of smoke, a wave, a ripple, you know, back then... Someone had to draw that. And the effects animation in Pinocchio was insane. Again, look at that Monstro sequence with the waves and each little spray of the ocean. Just how great that water looks. It's fantastic. And yeah, it's one of the best technical achievements in the film. And it's one of the reasons why even today Pinocchio is held as like one of the best animated films in history. So yeah, it's funny. I could just watch like those waves, you know?
It's very cool.
It's very cool. So getting to the casting now. We talked about the cast a bit in Snow White. That was a lot of radio personalities. And again, Walt has some money now, so we're going after some kind of some bigger stars here. Dickie Jones is Pinocchio. Dickie Jones is a boy. Originally, they brought in some adults to try to do like the boyish thing for Pinocchio. Walt didn't like it. He wanted a real boy. So they get this this kid named Dickie Jones, who that same year was actually in Jimmy Stewart's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and would have a pretty successful child career. And he's great in this. I think, like, as far as getting, like, a genuine child voice.
Well, because Pinocchio is such an innocent character, because he not only is he a little boy, but he's literally just come to be.
Right.
So it's a very wonderful performance in the way that everything is so delightful and
right. It's very
interesting to him.
It's a very naive, kind of happy-go-lucky performance. We have Cliff Edwards as Jiminy Cricket. He's also known as Ukulele Ike back in the day. He's a well-known personality. So this is almost like the first star casting in an animated film.
Theater, vaudeville.
Right. He had a number one hit with Singing in the Rain in 1929. That some people say was the first million-selling record ever. So he was very well-known, and his voice as Jiminy Cricket kind of stands for itself. We'll talk about that a bit in the next one. Kind of a sad story, though. He has a lot of money, alcohol, and drug problems later in his life. He kind of is known for hanging around the Walt Disney Studio kind of after this, in case they ever need work. And you kind of see Jiminy Cricket becoming a character in a lot of other
things. He kind of shows up a lot.
He shows up a lot. Part of that, I think they were kind of being generous to Cliff Edwards. And the Disney company is actually kind of tries to help them out as much as he can. When he does die later in the 70s, I think, no one claims his body. It's about to be donated to science. And Disney's about to buy it and pay for the funeral. Then I think some Actors Guild steps in first. So, yeah, kind of a sad story, but his role as Jiminy Cricket sort of is very iconic. Probably the most iconic performance in the film. One other interesting casting note is that Mel Blanc is a... Or Blank, how do you say Mel Blanc, is cast as Gideon, the sidekick cat to Honest Jean. Now, Mel Blanc is known as all, like, the Looney Tune voices, of course.
Yes.
And he recorded lines as Gideon. Gideon was going to be a talking character, but then Walt Disney's like, this will be better if he's mute. And, you know, it's funny. It's probably a good choice. But, yeah, so the only line that he has in there is a hiccup.
Which, actually, if you go to IMDb and look it up, it actually is credited as Gideon, and then in parentheses, hiccup. And that's it. Now, what boggles my mind, those recordings exist somewhere.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be fascinating to hear those?
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because Mel Blanc was also supposed to be
Dopey.
Dopey, and then that was another character who was turned to mute.
Yeah, now they never recorded anything,
no.
But he was originally lined up to do it.
Right. So I wonder if he's getting frustrated at this point.
Maybe there's a reason he was never in anything else from Disney.
Except
his appearances in Roger Rabbit, classic Warner Brothers
character.
Isn't
that kind of weird that somebody who's involved in this movie is involved in Who Framed Roger Rabbit later?
I never thought about that. Yeah.
It's weird to think of those movies in like a similar time frame. In fact, the last person alive who was involved in the production of Pinocchio died last year,
Dickie Jones.
So it's kind of a weird thing to think about. A little bit about the music. The songs are composed by Lee Harline with lyrics by Ned Washington. Goes on to actually win Oscars, too. One for Best Soundtrack and one for Best Song in When You Wish Upon a Star. When You Wish Upon a Star becomes sort of the anthem of the company and for our podcast, actually. Right. It's sort of the Disney song. They played it in the beginning of like all the Walt Disney shows. You hear it in the parks everywhere. When it's playing on loop in Disneyland, right? When you're in the castle and stuff. It's the theme song of the company. And it kind of epitomizes the company in a lot of ways. These Oscar wins are significant because this is the first legitimate Oscar wins for one of the feature films. Because Snow White got an honorary Oscar.
Yeah.
Right. It's also, I think, one of the first time that a film won soundtrack and best song at the same time.
Wouldn't happen again until Mary Poppins.
Yes. Okay. There you go. So, yeah, so the music, obviously, very good. We'll talk about that a bit more in the next thing. And then kind of the other big note about Pinocchio was its release. So, the budget on the movie really inflated.
From $500,000 to $2.5 million.
Right, and you think part of that was probably because, you know, Walt Disney stopping production halfway through and starting a lot of stuff over.
And I'm sure, you know, their ambitions grew as they were working.
Their ambitions
on
probably grew. Like I said, I think we were talking before how they were kind of on cloud nine. I think it got to their head a little bit.
And they had the money.
They had the money. Still, you don't want to waste money. I'm sure that Roy wasn't thrilled.
No.
I bet Roy was getting some gray hairs around this time. So yeah, it cost about $2.6 million to make. That's about twice as much as Snow White. And it only returns about half of that in its initial run. Now, there's people kind of use the word like, oh, it was like a box office disaster of the time. And it might be, it was definitely a big disappointment. Disaster might be stretching. It wasn't Home on the Range. You know what I mean? You know, it, obviously, Pinocchio is a huge classic right now. It's not like everyone was like, this film's terrible. It was critically really well received.
Yeah.
One of the other things that hurt its profits a lot was World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Cut off a lot of foreign distribution, which was very important for Snow White. So that hurts it as much as anything. Kind of by comparison, like... the top grossing film this year, I was trying to look into it. It's hard to get box office numbers on these old films.
Right.
Was Boomtown, which earned $3.6 million in the U.S. That was a Clark Gable picture.
Right, right.
So, in that kind of Gone with the Wind era where I think anybody just saw anything with Clark Gable in it. But, you know, they would make a lot of money back because of the reissuing strategy that they would take up pretty shortly after this.
Mm-hmm.
So Pinocchio makes money back, and obviously today it's known as one of the great classics. So, you know, people kind of like to dole out the, oh, it was a big box office bomb at the time thing. And none of the movies after Snow White make as much as Snow White do for a while.
Mm-hmm.
None of them are like a Snow White level hit again until, I think, Cinderella. Dumbo actually does pretty well for itself. Dumbo was a surprise hit. Also, Dumbo was really cheap.
Yeah.
And that's another legacy.
Funny how that works.
Yeah. Guess why Dumbo was so cheap? It's because this movie cost so much.
Yeah.
And Fantasia after it, really. So, all right. And, yeah, and also, but honestly, you know, the legacy of this film was kind of the craftsmanship of it. And it was important for a lot of ways, you know, because Snow White set everything running, but Pinocchio was a showcase for the studio. It was able to show that they still could do things. And it was a very different film from Snow White. It wasn't a princess fairy tale, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like what everybody kind of jumps to with this thing. But when you really look at a lot of those princess stories, at least until the 90s, they're all kind of spread out.
Yeah, people kind of, I think, almost lump Snow White and Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty together. But they're pretty far apart as chronologically,
right.
You know?
I mean, especially from Snow White to Cinderella.
Right.
And, you know, you look at those first five films, really, Snow White, Pinocchio, Fantasia, Bambi, Dumbo, all very different films. I think this kind of sets the tone for that. This sets the idea, again, of what we can do with animation. And in some ways, this is a story better suited for animation. Because, you know, you could do a Snow White movie in live action. People did. And I'm sure there was live action Pinocchio things. But having, like, a cricket sidekick character, you couldn't do that in live action at the time. Having, like, a realistic-looking puppet boy. And even just things like, you have, you know, Honest Joy and Gideon, they're fox characters. You have, think about the transformation of the boys into a donkey. There would be no way to do that in live action back then.
Certainly not.
Not really, unless, you know, they would cut away from it, and you cut back, and he's a donkey suddenly. So not nearly. So this, I think this story is taking advantage of the animation medium, and it's artistically one of the best achievements at the studio. And is there anything else you would like to say about this kind of behind the scenes stuff with Pinocchio?
I don't think so. I think I'm ready to talk about the movie.
All right, so let's take a short break here, listen to a little doo-dee-doo, whatever you pick, and then we'll get back to this.
An actor's life for me. Hi, an actor's life for me. A wax mustache and a beaver coat, a pony cart and a billy goat. Hi, billy dum, an actor's life is fun. You wear your hair in a pompadour, you ride around in a coach and four, you stop and buy out a candy store. An actor's life for me. Hi, diddly.
So, Mike, here we are, 75 years after the fact.
Wow.
And I think, as we talk about Snow White, it's hard to imagine many other movies that are over 70 years old holding up as well as Pinocchio.
Right. You know, it was a point we made with Snow White last episode. I think Pinocchio holds up even better. I think part of that is because of that Jiminy Cricket character kind of, you know, it's funny because he was like a contemporary character then. Even now he's got, you know, some of the characterisms of that are dated. But it makes it a bit more approachable.
Well, it still stands out in contrast to the rest of the world. He is a very American character in this Italian German-ish kind
of. Yeah, kind of more German-ish than Italian.
Well, I've done a little research into this, and part of what could explain
the Germanic influence?
Part of it is because they work so much in Germanic influence in Snow White, it was kind of easier to go that way.
Ah, that makes sense.
Also, there are regions in northern Italy, in the Alpine region,
that makes sense,
that
yeah.
actually are Germanic-speaking and have more Germanic influence. So, it's not unprecedented. And, you know, think about it. The movie has mountains in the backgrounds and stuff, so sure, we'll go with that.
Right.
But, so what I love about this movie is it does that, what had already been established as, like, the whole storybook opening thing from Snow White, but Jiminy Cricket is the one opening the story.
Right.
He's talking to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And also, real quick, it's really fun to see Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan back
then. Right.
Because back then, people were just like, whatever, but now we're like, ha, those came out.
It's interesting because he was playing those movies, and they wouldn't come out till quite a little bit later than anticipated because of the war and other factors, when we get the package films delaying things. But yeah, it's funny to see. Yeah, like, right now, your like kids would be like, oh, there's like a fun nod to their other movies. Like, those movies weren't out.
Yeah, didn't even remotely exist back
right?
then.
So, but, yeah, I just love this movie. This might be my favorite of those, of that first wave of great Disney movies. I think just the range that they achieve here, and it's, again, similar, Snow White had its, like, light moments and its dark moments, but I think Pinocchio's lights are lighter, and I think its dark parts are darker.
Mm-hmm.
I think the extremes are, like, really pushing limits. And we can just talk about it right now, that donkey scene. Is
terrifying.
It is intense.
It's awful.
It is, but it's gripping. It's nuts. It gets you, you know, no one's going to watch that scene today and, like, you know, not pay attention to it.
What's brilliant about it is, at first, when it's just like the ears turn and then his tail, it's kind of played for laughs
because
Pinocchio's reactions to it with his beer and his cigar are perfect. And even he starts laughing at it until he yeehaws.
Yeah.
But then once Lampwick realizes what's going on and goes in the full-on panic mode and then starts pawing at Pinocchio
it's
and that
terrifying.
Look on his face. And to see, because everything else was kind of like a little sleight of hand in how he transforms. But you literally see the hands clump into these hooves.
Yeah.
It's so scary.
And it's interesting because they make Lampwick's a very unsympathetic character. He's a very cocky character, and then to kind of hear him go from that to begging for his mommy.
Right, he just crumbles.
It's an awful fate.
I mean, it's not good.
They're
going to
become donkeys now and work in a salt mine. That's terrifying. A hard lesson for the kids.
Yeah. Should have
stayed in school, kids.
no pool halls, man.
Yeah, I like how bad. It's kind of one of the day things. Like, that pool was, like, on the same level as drinking and smoking and the evils. Like, Jimmy Kruger was like, look at you smoking, playing pool. Like, how dare you?
But to go to one of the lighter moments, honestly, the everything in Geppetto's workshop is fantastic.
That whole first act is...
All the clocks are so wonderful to see.
The clocks are great. And they made every clock in there was an actual one made.
Wouldn't it be
reference.
Wonderful to see those in action?
I wish those were
I'm
somewhere.
Sure they're in storage somewhere. They probably don't touch them.
It's funny because when you watch it, it seems like you're in Geppetto's workshop for a while. But it's time very well spent. Because you're establishing basically all the main characters. Establishing Jiminy, Geppetto, Pinocchio, and even Figaro, who is kind of the...
Rewatching this movie, Figaro steals the show for me.
Figaro's the breakout character. And one of the reasons why is because Walt Disney personally loved Figaro. And he would push the people to include him as much as they could. And Figaro kind of has a life beyond Pinocchio. He becomes Minnie Mouse's cat in a lot of shorts after this. So yeah, along with Jiminy Cricket, kind of the breakout star of Pinocchio's Figaro. But yeah, I think Figaro is hilarious. The best thing is when they're about to have that meal and Pinocchio's missing, and Geppetto got to look for him. He's like, you know, not a bite. And Figaro wants to eat his fish and
just pouts.
Yeah, that pouty face is just perfect.
But honestly, in this sequence comes, I think, my favorite piece of animation from this movie and really from this era.
Oh, I know.
And this is pretty much everything to do with puppet Pinocchio in the beginning,
right,
which was mostly done by Frank Thomas. So first you have Geppetto kind of puppeteering Pinocchio. And the wooden weight and the kind of haphazard movement he achieves is really remarkable.
Yeah, no, that is fantastic.
It really
anime.
Feels like a puppet affected by physics and not drawn by an animator.
Right, and again, that was one of the things where there wasn't a reference for it. He was just doing that.
He was just doing it,
which is insane.
But then it's taken to the next level when there's that point of view shot of Cleo, the goldfish, and Pinocchio's walking towards her fishbowl, and it's distorting through the bowl. And that's just mind-blowing how he did that by hand.
I feel like that scene, I think part of that scene was to show off. I think that was, again, a part of what I'm talking about, where Disney is kind of really sure of itself. They almost have a big head, and now they're like, all right, yeah, watch what we can do now.
Yeah, it's very impressive.
Right, now that whole sequence.
And I think it serves a wonderful contrast, because we talked about this in the last segment, that part of the production issue was that Pinocchio was too wooden. But now you have this scene where he's purely wooden, and he's that when he comes alive, he's even more alive.
Right, because the juxtaposition of like that lifeless Pinocchio is very striking.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like I said, when you watch it now, it seems like a long scene, but to establish all of that and everything you got going on is great. It's just delightful. Geppetto's little songs and dance numbers and everything.
It's all very happy.
Yeah, it's all very nice, isn't it? So. What are we going to talk about next here?
I think we should talk about Honest John and Gideon, because they're kind of recurring characters.
They're interesting.
That kind of set up each... We talked about how the story was serialized.
Right.
Which is very evident in the movie. It's very episodic in Pinocchio's little adventures throughout. And for most of the time, Honest John and Gideon are the ones who are kind of the catalyst for each of these misadventures that Pinocchio finds himself
in. In fact, there was really supposed to be a scene where... towards the end of the film, they approach Pinocchio again, and Pinocchio finally declines them. Then they go to jail, which would have been maybe a nice
time. See them get their comeuppance.
You don't need it, I don't think. One thing I love about those two characters, is that there's kind of a trope called "even evil has standards," where when the bad guys in the film are suddenly freaked out about something else, stuff's about to get real. So when that coachman is like, yeah, we're going to turn all the boys into donkeys.
And they're like, that's terrible. Yeah.
And a moment before that's like, oh, do you need us to kill anybody? Right. But they're interesting characters. Also, anamorphized, or what's that word?
Morphine? Anthropomorphized.
That's a hard word.
It is a tricky word.
They're fox and cats.
Yeah, people. It's funny because they're walking. One of my favorite lines of the movie is when they're walking the street. Oh, a little wooden boy. A little wooden boy. But at the same time, oh, a talking fox and a cat.
Yeah, it's never really addressed.
Thinks anything of that.
Well, that's kind of one of the
the magic of animation.
Well, it's something about the tone of this movie where it's a bit more fantasy, maybe the word, but a bit more things are kind of. Jimmy Cricket, by the way, doesn't look anything like a cricket.
Yeah,
we only know he's a cricket because we're told he is.
Right.
And there's a lot of that in the movie, and it kind of works. But there's that scene with Honest John where he does, his doctor's diagnosis.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's fantastic.
It's like fast
comedy. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Things come one after the other there. I think one of my other favorite sequences is the No Strings on Me. The great musical number too, but again, it kind of goes back to before, like the animation of those puppets and stuff like that.
It's also funny too, it's one of those weird quirks where Pinocchio does that little thing where he swings his feet around his knee joint, but even when you look at him, that shouldn't work.
Yeah, right.
But you just kind of accept it.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't. Yeah. It's like, wait, the joints aren't lined. Wait. Oh, whatever. Yeah, that's all good.
But yeah, so we talked about Stromboli a bit in the last segment, and again, it's wonderful because he vacillates so quickly between this jolly showman to this threatening, menacing, larger-than-life villain.
Right, yeah, one of the scarier characters in the film. It's interesting because there's no one villain in the movie, and again, part of that is because of the episodic nature, where each episode kind of has its own villain. Because
even the coachman, he's doing something real terrible, but it's not like he's after Pinocchio. He doesn't even know Pinocchio's there, really.
Yeah, really. He's not a force against Pinocchio, per se. Well, a lot of the stuff is sort of Pinocchio's fault and stuff that he has to deal with. And, you're even saying in their film, Pinocchio's kind of a jerk. But, again, to that point, he's very naive. He's very innocent. And like a lot of kids, he kind of goes along with what people tell him to do, and a lot of the movie is him learning, it is him learning to follow his conscience. He even says early on that he doesn't know the difference between right and wrong, and that's what Jiminy Cricket is there for. And that's kind of what each of these episodes are about. So one of the things is that we have if we want to talk about a fault with the movie, is there's a bit of divine intervention at times helping out. I think it works better the first time in Stromboli's cart when the Blue Fairy appears to save him.
Because she teaches him a lesson before she helps him.
Mm-hmm, right.
About lying.
Yeah, it's interesting, too. That's the only scene where the nose thing happens.
But it's so iconic of the character.
All right, like anytime you hear Pinocchio, like, oh, the nose, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah, it only happens that one time, really. But the Blue Fairy's second appearance,
As a dove
who, like, just literally drops a note when they don't know where to go next with the story, basically. Because, yeah, they go back to Geppetto's workshop, and Geppetto's not there. Like, what do we do now? And then you can tell a little bit, like, we don't know how to tell him that Geppetto's gone.
Yeah. But it still works in the
context. It's fine because, you know, you can throw the word Deus Ex Machina. A Deus Ex Machina solves the issue of the story. This doesn't necessarily... It's not like the Blue Fairy comes in at the end and gets them out of the whale. That would be bad. So this is maybe not the most creative way to further the story. But again, we're going with that episodic nature. It's like, well, how do we go from the end of the Pleasure Island scenario into this? We don't know. I think that third act, though, might be my favorite part of the movie. Just, again, with Monstro. Monstro is so incredible. Terrifying.
To this day, because of this movie, my greatest irrational fear in life is being swallowed by a whale. And people think that's ridiculous, and I agree, it's ridiculous. But,
right.
I mean, there's Geppetto in a boat, in a whale, starving to death. And here's the thing, too. When I was a kid, I didn't like fish.
Yeah.
So that was no help to me.
Well, I bet if you were starving inside a whale,
I like tuna now.
You would come around to it a little bit. But, yeah... Just and there's something again. He's not a Disney-fied whale, right? He's terrifying, and he's not realistic either.
No, he's like a weird combination of like a sperm whale with the teeth, but a blue whale in body.
He's huge, right?
And he shows a strange malice, like you know, a real whale. If you in theory were swallowed by it and got out, I don't think he'd be like, "Hey, get back in here! I'm gonna get you," and like you know, chase you to the ends of the earth.
But that's you know, he works because he is a force of evil, almost like a force of nature, especially with the way he's just careening around and like that chasing from him is so intense.
Yeah. Also, very fortunate that Figaro and Cleo just wash up on the shore together.
You do wonder, like,
where were they up to?
What happened to them? Where did they go? But you have, like, a sad scene there, too, where, like, Pinocchio's dead.
Although, there is a little bit of an anachronism there, too.
Well, people say that Pinocchio drowned, but even though he's underwater before, I never read it as he drowned. I assume that some sort of impact from Monstro knocked him out or something.
All right, we'll go with that.
I don't know. But again, you know, it's great because you have the intense grieving scene, then you immediately have the jubilation of his boyhood coming to him and stuff.
Yeah.
It's always weird seeing the full boy Pinocchio, right?
Yeah, it almost looks wrong because you're so used to the puppet.
Right, yeah, you see full-on boy Pinocchio there.
And also, I mean, it's a joke that, like, so many movies do, but this might be the first time, I don't know, but I love when... He's like, you know, why are you crying? Because you're dead. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. Now lie down.
It's wonderful. There's a lot of great just lines like that. I love, like, Geppetto getting Figaro to open the door of the window.
The window. It's like, oh, Figaro. I forgot to open the window.
I love when Jiminy and Pinocchio are kind of moping in the cage, and they're both crying and talking about how it's their fault. And Judy's like, here, Pinocchio, be cheerful. Like you mean? He's like, got this exaggerated.
Ridiculous frown. It's so good.
Right. Oh, God. So what do you think is your favorite thing about Pinocchio?
I think it's the two things. I love I love the animation of the puppet form of Pinocchio. Because it's kind of a good look at Geppetto's character, I think. Because, you know, he kicks the cat with the puppet.
Yeah,
it's something I would do.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I don't like cats as much as him. But also, I think the transformation of Lampwick into the donkey might be my favorite part of the movie for its impact, its animation, everything that scene goes for, which, like I said, 75 years later, still pretty scary.
Right. Yeah, I guess, like, the emotional pacing is just kind of my favorite thing. Again, going from those highs and those lows... Getting to, like, those really dark moments, having those really funny moments. It's a very cathartic film all around, and it's one that I could watch again and again. You always kind of notice a little something here or there. So, yeah, just one of the masterworks of the Disney company is Pinocchio. Well, all right then. I guess we'll take another little break here. When we come back, we're going to see how Pinocchio was presented in the Disney theme parks, which should be fun. So we'll see you in a little bit.
Hi, ho, the merry o. That's the only way to go. I want the world to know. Nothing ever worries me. I got no strings, so I have fun. I'm not tied up to anyone. They got strings, but you can see there are no strings on me.
One of the interesting things about Pinocchio in the theme parks is, and you kind of did the research for this segment, so you can tell me, it seems like he has a bigger Disneyland presence than a Disney World one.
That's, well, it's factually true. So, what happened was when Disneyland was being planned, there were a lot of ride ideas that got thrown out, a large part because the money wasn't available because of the deal with ABC. Where they were making portions of the proceeds from the park until Disney bought ABC.
Right.
So a lot of different ideas were talked about for Fantasyland, where Pinocchio would fit. But the problem is, Fantasyland was kind of set. It had a lot of rides that were popular.
Right.
So,
whereas meanwhile you have Tomorrowland with the Hall of Aluminum Fame.
Right, and you know, Frontierland needed more attractions.
Right, then a Davy Crockett Museum.
So while... The one presence that Pinocchio did have was in the storybook land canals. And, you know, as you know, you go into Monstro's mouth. Mm-hmm. So there's this very prominent Monstro in Fantasyland. And when they add the dioramas and, you know, make it the storybook land canals, the Pinocchio village is one of the dioramas.
Wait, I'm a little... Were the dioramas never originally not part of it?
I'm not... I didn't do as much research into the history of this particular ride.
Yeah,
not
fair
really
enough.
Pinocchio ride, but I know the dioramas were added.
Interesting. So at one point it was just kind of like a little boat ride.
Yeah, you know.
Okay.
Check out some gardens and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, the cast members explained to you that, and you know, this doesn't follow the canon at all, but that somehow Pinocchio blasts a hole in the back of Monstro and that's how they get out. Because you go into them, you have to get out somehow.
Right, right.
But originally, they had a different idea for a Pinocchio ride, really a Monstro ride in Disneyland. So there's a very famous sort of amusement park ride called a Shoot the Chutes, which is a flume ride of sorts, where you literally just went up a lift hill, 180-degree turn, drop back down into a lagoon and splashed. So Disney being Disney, of course, as you were going up and once you got to the top, you would have gone past some dioramas of Pinocchio's story until you were swallowed by Monstro and you escape by sliding out of his mouth. So the exterior of the ride would have been a very large model of Monstro and the chute would have been his tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Which would have been cool. I don't know. It's hard to say what the exact scale
of
this
would have
been. Yeah,
I was wondering, like, is this going to be like a Splash Mountain? Probably not.
Yeah, probably more like 20 feet at most.
Right.
But still would have been neat. And then you would have had that area called Pinocchio Harbor.
Oh, okay. That would have been kind of neat. Because that whole village of Pinocchio is so beautiful looking. And you see some of that in Fantasyland, at least when it was reimagined anyways. Mm-hmm. Fantasyland kind of looks a lot like that Pinocchio village. But that it's interesting that one of the precursors of Splash Mountain is this Monstro ride idea, right?
Yeah.
But even what you get, I do love that storybook canals. I love that Monstro there. I love that he's kind of a fixture of Fantasyland back there.
Right. It is nice.
Mm-hmm, we just went on this ride for the first time, really, this year. At least it was the first time for me.
Yeah, me too.
And it was a charming ride. It's fun.
Cute,
and,
yeah.
They just added Frozen stuff to it.
They replaced something.
The old mill.
That's it.
Which I don't know if they moved there or just replaced it, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, so they moved the old mill.
So, in the 70s, around 1976, they closed the Mickey Mouse Club Theater in Disneyland. And the idea was to put in a Pinocchio attraction. That would have been a dark ride, ride vehicles that looked like they were fastened by Geppetto. Mm-hmm. And for all sorts of various reasons, it just kind of never happened. Until they went about getting ready for the new Fantasyland of the 80s. So, I actually hadn't realized this, that... The Pinocchio's Daring Journey ride that's still there today, not only did it not open until May of 1983 in Disneyland, it actually opened first in Tokyo Disneyland in April of 1983.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that ride's a lot newer than you realize.
Than a lot of people would think. Cause,
because
there's a reason why... Well, the original dark rides were Snow White, Mr. Toad, and Peter Pan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why those three also went over to Disney World. And then in the new Fantasyland in the 80s, you have Pinocchio's Daring Journey, and you also have Alice in Wonderland, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then that was kind of a big part of that was adding these two new dark rides. And again, that's why you don't have those in Disney World.
And they do some very cool effects in this ride. They use the Pepper's Ghost illusion from the Haunted Mansion to make the Blue Fairy disappear. Mm-hmm. They use some kind of rudimentary holographic tricks for when Lampwick turns into the donkey, because he's looking in a mirror, and you can see his mirror, his back's to you. Mm. But in the mirror, you see the boy, and then he turns, and he's a donkey.
Right.
So, you know, some neat effects. You know, it's kind of cool at the end, Monstro kind of comes up at you, and there's, like, lighting effects to kind of help sell it.
You know, and again, it's we've always went to Disney World much more growing up. We went every year to Disneyland. Mm-hmm. We've been a few times. This is kind of one of the things I almost wish was in Disney World, again, because I love Pinocchio, but it's a fun dark ride.
Yeah, it's very well done.
Mm-hmm.
So, in Disney World, and in several other Disney parks, the big presence there is really Pinocchio's Village House, which, again, has that kind of, is it German, is it Italian sort of thing, because I actually just ate there for the first time on my honeymoon this past summer, and it's flatbreads and kind of more Italian fare. It used to be more German.
I think, yeah, right? Yeah. Well, did it a lot. I feel like back when we were kids, almost all of these restaurants had the same menu. It was all just burgers.
Yeah. It was a little homogenized.
Yeah,
like
right. But yeah. They've done a much better job lately of diversifying.
Right. Things. So to give a little food review, the flatbreads they serve there are really good.
What are we talking about here?
My wife had a pepperoni flatbread. I had a margarita, so it was like tomatoes and fresh mozzarella. But yeah, like it's what's neat about the restaurant is all the different rooms are kind of themed after a different character or characters a little bit. So we were in the room that was kind of Geppetto's room.
Oh,
so
that'd be cool.
There was a great little mural on the wall, the painting of Geppetto with his little accordion thing dancing with Pinocchio. Yeah. And it had the lyrics on the wall.
Oh.
Funny little boy of wooden string.
Oh, that's nice.
Or whatever. How does it go?
Yeah.
Bring a little joy to every heart. Yeah, like, it's neat little touches. Plus, it's also cool that there is the room in there that looks out over the loading area for It's a Small World. And you see, right. You always, when you're riding Small World, you look up and there's always kids waving at you and you wave back and vice versa. So it's a great little place. It's it also has some nice outdoor seating area there that I feel like a lot of people don't really utilize.
I mean, it's, at least until you kind of had the Be Our Guest restaurant, it was kind of the most prominent dining area in the parks. I feel I kind of want to go. I feel like now I really want to go there again. I always go to Starlight Ray's Cosmic Cafe just because I like that animatronic.
Right, who doesn't?
Starlight Ray. But it's very. But because of that, you have like a Chuck E. Cheese effect in there where it's like a bit nuts sometimes.
Yeah, kids. And everyone's trying to sit by Sunny Eclipse, which is where you want to sit, of course.
I want to sit by Sunny Eclipse, man. But yeah, I love that restaurant, though. Mm-hmm. And do you know how old is the Village House?
I don't exactly have a date for it. I don't know if it's original.
Original might seem like much. So what else do you got, though? I'll look that
up. So, beyond attractions and restaurants, Pinocchio has a big presence throughout the park in a lot of different ways. Jiminy Cricket kind of has become the de facto night entertainment host, at least in Disney World.
Yeah, right?
So he was the host for Spectro Magic. He's the host for Wishes. And of course, the Blue Fairy plays a big part in Wishes because she's the one granting the wish. Also, in Fantasmic, Pinocchio has a big presence, more so in Disneyland. They both feature, Jiminy and his bubble during the water projections. And then Monstro is kind of a big. He's kind of really the first villain to impact the story of Fantasmic in a lot of ways. You know, he sends Mickey spiraling into a whirlpool. But in the Disneyland version, kind of instead of the big jungle scene you get in Florida, in California, you have the No Strings on Me dance sequence. And it's really black lighting and puppeteers. So the puppeteers are in black leotards, basically, and they're just manipulating all these black light painted puppets, and they dance to the sequence and everything like that.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, but
I
love Jiminy Cricket as kind of the host of a lot of...
It totally works. You know, he even says, like, you know, I'm just a cricket, but night's my favorite time.
Something about his kind of his folksy charm.
Right, it works very well.
I'm having a hard time finding that date, by the way.
Yeah,
I tell you what, you can look it up before you do before we do the stinger. We can look that up, huh?
We could try.
Yeah. But there's a presence all over the place. You know, there's that little Pinocchio statuette by the partner statue,
mm-hmm.
like that, and one that you don't immediately think of as a Pinocchio thing necessarily, but Pleasure Island.
Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, it's a totally different
thing.
By
name only, really.
Yeah, I mean, it was the whole Meriwether Pleasure founded it.
They come up with a completely different name, but Pleasure, I mean, it's...
It is there.
Right, it's Pleasure Island from the Pinocchio thing. Completely different. Wouldn't it be weird if they had if they actually had Pleasure Island like it was?
With Tobacco Row?
Can you imagine that? Animatronics just throwing cigars to the kids? There you go, kids! The Roughhouse, the meanest, toughest.
Hey, you know who's the voice of that Roughhouse statue?
No.
Ducky Nash.
Oh my god, are
you
kidding me?
Yeah, there you go. He was the voice of a bunch of donkeys, too.
That's interesting. You know, again, another little trivia thing. Cliff Edwards, Jiminy Cricket, he was also the voice of the lead crow in Dumbo.
Well, there you go.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's pretty much the run.
I mean, the biggest thing is...
The biggest thing is obviously the ride that they have.
Right, which again, that's interesting.
It's only 22 years old.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, again, Pinocchio, very much like Snow White, it's one of those things you'll find throughout the park with a lot of those originals, the kind of standards. You know, you're probably going to see at least the Pinocchio character walking around in a parade.
Yeah, and actually, a large number of the characters from this movie are walk-around characters. Pinocchio, Geppetto, Honest John and Gideon.
You know what?
Jiminy Cricket.
I have to say, I don't know why, but I feel like you don't see a Jiminy Cricket walk around that often. As often as you would think.
Well, especially in the parades, they like Inspector of Magic. Because they want the scale. So they use a little puppet / animatronic for him. But I have seen the walk around Jiminy Cricket. And
okay.
He is a thing.
Yeah, along with like Tinkerbell, he's become kind of a mascot for the company, but more so the parks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right then. Well, that was, again, good stuff. I always love looking at the stuff in this park. So a lot of fantasy land, huh?
Especially a lot of fantasy.
But these older movies.
That's going to be the story of a lot of these first few episodes here. It's a lot of fantasy
land. Then towards the end, we get back to nice fantasy land again.
Yeah, what do you know?
Fantasy land again. All right. So let's take a little break here, and we'll wrap things up and get going with our march towards Fantasia.
Ooh. Bam.
All right, so in the 2 minutes we took to try to find when the Pinocchio Village House opened, our attempts were fruitless.
History is lost. Scholars shall debate it.
Was
for
it
years
always the Village House? And I want to know. I got to find this out. I got to really dig deep.
Someday. Yeah,
if you know, contact us. And AJ, how can you contact our show to tell us this information that we should have maybe told them?
Oh, that's very easy. You can check out our website at worldofdisneyanimation.com, where you can find our past episodes, upcoming episodes, and fill out the convenient contact form we have to email us. You can also, from the website, find some Amazon links to the movies we talked about, some of the research materials.
Unfortunately, Pinocchio's Blu-ray is hard to get now.
Yeah, that's kind of the bummer about the old vault. Disney vault.
Someday, man, there's just going to be like a digital like Netflix thing with all these. Although maybe not, because they can make so much money from just
releasing. Well, it's weird because there is the Disney My Movies app, and Pinocchio is listed as in the vault, but they list the bonus features you would get with it, which I'm like... That's odd. So maybe it's coming soon. Who knows?
It's what's another interesting thing though is like, you know, they're still re-releasing Pinocchio. They're still making money off this movie.
Yeah, right.
Right.
But you can also follow us on Twitter at WODA Podcast, WODA Podcast, and drop us a line there. And yeah, we're going to be doing Fantasia next.
Yeah, that'll be a hard episode because
it's all over the place.
It's like a bunch of mini sequences.
Yeah, I mean honestly,
there's books.
Do we break that one up? I don't know.
No, we better do one episode. Maybe we'll see. But yeah, there are books on Fantasia. So
yeah,
there'll be a lot
to talk about.
There's a lot to say about Fantasia. So that'll be an interesting show. But again, like man. Snow White, Pinocchio, Fantasia. Quite a role they're on here.
Yes.
Right, so thanks for listening to our Pinocchio episode.
Yeah, make sure you subscribe to our show.
Oh, wait, that's right. We got to rate Pinocchio.
Oh, God, what am I doing? Yeah.
You know what? So we gave Snow White a 95. I like Pinocchio a little bit more than Snow White.
So you're going to go 97?
I want to like say like 97. What do you think, though?
I think a 97 is a very fair number for
Pinocchio. All right, Pinocchio, 97. better than Snow White.
In every way.
Snow White already taken off the number one.
It's two better.
We already know Snow White is not the best Disney animated film of all time.
So, yes, there you go. Pinocchio, arrivederci, we will see.
Yeah, we Italian, are Italian, right?
Italian classic.
Yeah, yeah, so Italian with their... Yes. Germanic houses.
So check out our upcoming episode on Fantasia. Go to worlddisneyanimation.com. Subscribe to us via iTunes, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, or our RSS feed into your favorite podcast application. And any of those services, please subscribe. Leave us a review because that'll help the show get out there. And tell your friends. Tweet it. Facebook it. Instagram it. I don't know how you Instagram a podcast.
Oh, you can Instagram it.
There are ways. We have nice cover art. So, yeah. Thanks for listening.
And next time...
This is terribly contrasting with whatever music is playing right now.
The melody to their ears. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
When your heart is in your dream, no request is too early.